yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions, where we talk to folks in the grassroots where the real action is and try to provide their vision of what's going on in the U.S. today. And we're going to turn back to a topic several months ago where we had a discussion, and that's on the immigrants' rights movement, which is very appropriate at this given moment, given some recent new developments and a resurgence of the immigrants' rights movement as some very important decisions are beginning to appear at the government level here shortly. My guests today are two gentlemen who are active on the ground in this movement, playing an important role. One is Mr. Nativo Lopez, who I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Nativo, but you're associated with the Mexican-American Political Association, I think?
No, the organization is the Hermandad Mexicana, the National Mexican Brotherhood.
Okay, Hermandad Mexicana. And we have David Bacon as well, longtime activist, labor activist, and involved in fighting for immigrant rights. David, are you on?
I am.
Okay, very good. Well, let me just give the listeners a little bit of background, and then we're going to jump right in this. What I'd like either or both of you to do when you get a chance to comment here after my brief intros, to say something for the listeners about a little bit about the background of the movement, maybe from the Great March here of several years ago, and what are the central issues today, what the Obama administration is doing or not doing, what it should be or could be doing, and what are the demands of the movement today that may be similar or different than they were a few years ago? For the listeners, we have a real problem of massive deportations of folks going on here since Obama came into office. Most people aren't aware of it, but they've been running about 400,000 a year, people being deported. So almost 2.5 million people have been forcibly deported since Obama came into office. Obama, by far, his administration, has held the record for forced deportations. And, people have to realize that a lot of these are families, been here for many years, and the family's broken up, parents sent back, kids, well, where are they going to stay? Maybe they got relatives, maybe they got friends. It's a real tragedy. It's really terrible what has been going on, and of course it doesn't get enough or very much even coverage in the media, even though it's such a dramatic human tragedy, forced migration, you might call it. There are some demands here and a review going on in the Obama administration about, well, maybe we shouldn't send everybody back, some discussion about some changes, perhaps. Relatively few of the people being deported are really criminals with felony charges, legitimate felony charges. So it's become so dramatically abusive that even the Obama administration is looking at maybe changing something. Of course, that has a lot to do with the midterm elections. By the way, with regard to elections, if people look at how Obama got into office, look at those key states in 2012 where he swung the vote. What made the difference? Well, it was labor votes in those key states, and it was Latino votes in those key states. Without that vote, and youth vote as well, Obama might not have won the last election. Well, this is a pretty shabby way to treat the people who put you in office, I would say. Anyway, I've had my say on this. That's my two cents, which isn't worth much. But let's talk to the folks who are there in the on the ground in the struggle every day. Nativa, why don't we start with you? Tell us, you know, just give us your view. What's happening recently? What's new? What's different? And what's really going on at the grassroots with regard to this movement?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me on the show, Jack. I want to preface my remarks by saying that, I mean, you're asking about what's new, and for your listeners, it's important to understand that the immigrant rights movement is not a new movement. Actually, it's a historical movement. The immigrant rights movement was born the day that the United States illegally annexed half of the territory of Mexico and imposed a border and therefore created difficulty for people to pass to what was previously their own homeland. So it's a historical movement, although today it doesn't take the form of calling for return of the territory, but it certainly does take the form of demanding human rights, immigrant rights, civil rights, workers' rights, and basically that immigrants, not only from Mexico, from other countries throughout the world, are essentially workers. They have rights like other workers, domestic workers, native-born workers that are here, and those rights should be respected. As I know that David will elaborate on in great detail, workers are here because there's a tremendous demand for their labor. So there's causes that are associated with them being here. And most of the time, we're just addressing the issues of symptoms. So, for example, trade policies of the United States have tremendous influence and directly correlate to the migration from the sending countries to the United States to fulfill the labor demands, the cheap labor demands that are required in the United States. So today, we find ourselves at a crossroads in that, as you mentioned, had it not been for the Latino vote, for the youth vote, for labor vote, certainly this president would not be in office. He has effectively deported over 2 million individuals. But I want to share with you and your listeners a statistic that is little mentioned or known about. According to the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, there are now approximately 450 to 500,000 American citizen minors de facto deported to Mexico, obligated to accompany their deported undocumented parents to Mexico alone. There are more American citizen minors that have been repatriated to Mexico than all of the deportees of the 1930s, where the country witnessed the repatriation movement under an act enacted at that time by Congress, in which Mexicans were forcibly or intimidated to leave the United States, some 360,000 to Mexico alone. So it's a historic record that the Obama administration has set in terms of the removals, and left to its own devices, by the end of his second term, he will have deported more than 3 million migrants, separated families. 25% of those that have been deported already from the United States actually have American-born children. So in other words, they have equities. They have been here for years. But that's a sorry record of this administration. And so I know in the course of the program we'll get into what are the demands of the immigrant rights movement today. But that pretty much sets a setting for you about what's occurring. And that's why so many organizations throughout the country are demanding on the president that he stop the deportation machine. That if he initiated this with the idea that he would get concessions from the Republicans to pass immigration reform in his first term or his second term, that has not worked. And therefore, people are demanding that he cease the deportations and extend administrative relief to all those that are eligible in the country currently.
Wow, that is, listeners should, it's worth repeating for listeners that it's not just 3 million that have been deported, but hundreds of thousands of those 3 million are American citizens. I don't think we've ever had anything quite like that, and they're mostly children and youth. Hundreds of thousands of American citizens deported? I mean, why isn't there more of an uproar? It's amazing, you know, that that this issue and that element of this issue is not really being brought to the public so people would be aware of what's going on.
Yeah, it's 2 million. It's 2 million been deported, Jack, not 3 million. But the American citizens, I say de facto deported, because if your parents are deported, you are left involuntarily abandoned. What are you to do but accompany your parents? And so effectively, the American citizen has been repatriated. Nice word for saying removed or deported with the undocumented deported parents. So that's the situation currently.
Yeah, just to clarify the actual numbers, if people want to go to the Wall Street Journal of April 24th, that was yesterday, there's a nice graph there that shows the exact numbers since 2008, and they run typically about 400,000 every year for the past 6 years. So that's approaching 2.5 million, well more than 2 million. So that's a fact. No one's inflating any numbers here about these deportations. You mentioned in your comment, Nativo, about the trade policies of the U.S. influencing immigration. I know David has done a lot of work on NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, and its impact. Just for the listeners, you know, NAFTA, free trade, you know, what that's really about, folks, is not exchanging goods and services between Mexico and the U.S. and Canada. It's really about American businesses being able to move into Mexico and displace workers down there, particularly in agriculture. So what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to starve when Cargill and Archer Daniel Midland's start growing cheap corn and sending it to Mexico and moving down there. Folks just have to work and survive somehow. So I don't know. That's my view. That's why we get this immigration coming north. It's because of the free trade agreement, significantly, I think. David, would you like to comment on that, or your views on that whole question of trade and labor immigration?
Sure. And before getting to NAFTA, I think that it's important to preface it with a couple of things. First of all, I think that Nativo put his finger on it when you said, Nativo, that the migration system is driven by this enormous labor need that the United States has and has had historically ever since plantations were set up and slaves were brought in chains from Africa before this country even existed. So one historical note, for instance, is that actually this isn't the highest number of people deported in our history. The highest number of people that were ever deported from the United States in 1 year was in 1954, when the United States deported 1,054,000 people. But by no coincidence, that year also the United States brought in, imported, 450,000 people under the notorious Bracero program, which was this kind of, well, these days we call it a guest worker program, but really this is kind of like a semi-slave labor program in which people are brought here under contract to employers here. They work at the absolute minimum wage. People have to leave once the work is over. If they go on strike or they lose a job, they become deportable. Really, it's a program for supplying very, very vulnerable labor to employers in this country. And we had this program from 1942 to 1964. So here on the one hand, the United States is deporting 1 million people and then bringing in 450,000. You kind of ask yourself why. Today, as you said, you know, last 5 years we've deported 2 million people, the administration has, but a very little-known statistic that you won't read in the Wall Street Journal, I don't think, is that there are now between 700,000 and 900,000 people every year working in the United States under what are called work visas, which is sort of a modified version of what the old Bracero program looked like. So deportations and enforcement and these work programs are connected. And I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, there's a big apple ranch in eastern Washington called Gebbers Farms. At Gebbers Farms, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Immigration Enforcement Arm, federal government, went to that company. It looked through the personnel records. It picked out the names of about 500 people that the government said didn't have papers, and it told Gebbers to fire them. Gebbers said, well, what am I going to do for workers? You know, there's no workers here in eastern Washington, or very few, you know, without these folks here who have been working for me for years and years and years, what am I going to do? So the government then said to him, well, we will give you 800 workers, these people mostly actually from Jamaica at that time, on what are called H-2A visas. In other words, visas that are like the old Bracero program, people who are brought, recruited, in this case in Jamaica, but it happens in Mexico and Central America as well, too, brought to the United States, and then are held in this kind of semi-captive condition in which they work for, again, you know, the absolute rock-bottom wages. And, you know, this is not just a one-time thing. Right now, there are another 400 workers at another farm in Washington called Sukuma Brothers Farms who went on strike last year. These are immigrants from Mexico, people mostly from Oaxaca, who've been working at this farm every year. Last year they went on strike because the wages got so bad and the conditions in the labor camp got so bad, people started to complain, the company fired people, people went out on strike. The season ended. This year, that company has applied for visas for 438 of these guest workers, so-called, to come and replace the people who went out on strike. So these kind of labor programs are a weapon, really, that employers have, that they use against workers, overwhelmingly immigrant workers themselves, when they stand up and they fight for something better. So what we really have here are two sides of one coin, kind of. We have the enforcement, which makes people vulnerable, which also is used as a weapon by employers, and then we have these labor programs. Both of these are the central element in the big immigration bills that have been proposed in Congress over the last 8 years. These bills, even though they're called comprehensive immigration reform, what they really are they are labor bills, because the central part of them are, again, these kind of guest worker programs. In order to force people into those programs, they have big increases in enforcement. So you have programs that lead to even more firings for people for not having papers. You have, you know, even more deportations. You crank up the enforcement. You build more detention centers. You hold more people in detention centers. And then, as sort of the carrot on this big stick, we get a little bit of legalization, but not much. Not legalization for all the people who are here in the United States who need it, about 11 million people, maybe half that, maybe even less than that. Those bills have been stuck in Congress. You know, Congress is paralyzed. It can't pass any of them. So what the administration is doing is it's just implementing them on the ground. So in other words, without Congress passing the bill, we have this huge increase in enforcement. The deportations, we have thousands and thousands of people being fired every year because they don't have papers. And we have this huge increase in these labor programs. In other words, in people coming to the United States after having been recruited by employers in another country, mostly Mexico, and then brought here to work in the fields, to work in hospitals, to work in all kinds of different jobs. This is, you know, the kind of economic reason why this enforcement is happening. And what it's doing...
Go ahead.
So the last element to it is, you know, what you were talking about, which is the push on people to come here to begin with. Because in the, at the same time, the United States has negotiated these trade agreements. So NAFTA is a good example of it, but there are many other agreements like it, like the Central America Agreement, which has the same effect. And these agreements, as you pointed out, Jack, are agreements that allow U.S. companies to operate in Mexico, whether it is relocating production down there, in other words, closing factories here, opening them up there, whether it's buying up privatized assets that formerly belonged to the Mexican government, or whether it is dumping agricultural products like corn or meat on the Mexican market in order to take it over. All of those things lead to really terrible situations for the workers and the farmers involved. You know, when the Mexican government set up the electrical company in central Mexico that belonged to the Mexican government for privatization, what it did was it declared that the company didn't exist. It declared that, therefore, the workers didn't have any jobs and fired 44,000 people. It tried to destroy their union. 44,000 people in Mexico City getting fired all at one time. Again, those people are going to have to do something to survive. The treaty let big U.S. corporations like Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, and others dump corn on the Mexican market. So the corn exports to Mexico went from 2 million tons a year to 10 million tons a year in the time that NAFTA was in effect, basically selling corn that we subsidized with our tax money through the Farm Bill in Mexico at a price that was so low in order to take over that market that Mexican farmers couldn't sell their corn for what it cost to grow it. So people had to do something in order to survive, as you said. And basically what people had to do is they had to leave home and go look for work, whether that was in Mexico City, whether it was in the maquiladora factories on the border, or whether it was crossing the border and coming here as workers. So as a result of it, in 94, when the treaty went into effect, there were about 4.5 million people who have been born in Mexico but were living in the United States. Today, there are about 12.5 million people who were born in Mexico who are living here. That is the cost of that trade agreement. That is the push factor that then the U.S. employers are depending on, really, in industries like agriculture or meatpacking or building services, cleaning buildings, all over the place. And that's why these labor programs are such an important part of what they're looking for in immigration reform.
Well, from what you said, a lot of interesting facts there. Thank you for that input. Correct me if I'm wrong, David, but we have the government, the Obama administration, you're telling me, has introduced labor programs by executive order that brings in hundreds of thousands of immigrants to work in American businesses at what is essentially below minimum wage and normal labor standards. That kind of immigration is okay. But if you've got people in the country who are just competing for jobs according to the market, those immigrants aren't welcome, and they got to go home to be replaced by official immigrants on these programs that are almost like work programs, you might say, prison work programs almost, where they come in at lower wages. In other words, if you're willing to work and the government will let you come in if you want to work below subpar wages on and conditions on a government program, but if you're here and you're not on those programs, then go home. That's what it sounds like to me. And if the Obama administration has the power to create those by executive order, why doesn't it create by executive order other programs to provide benefits and better conditions for those who are already here? Obama says I can't do anything because of the Republicans in Congress. Well, is that true? Can he do things if he really wanted to? Nativo, what do you think?
Well, it's not that he's creating these programs by executive order. These programs already exist in law. He is essentially expanding them.
Okay.
By permitting the Department of Homeland Security to expand the number of available visas. And what the public should know is that we're not talking about workers that are brought to the United States merely to work in agriculture. That was the case in previous eras, but today there are categories of work visas that allow technical workers to enter the United States and work in, you know, high-skilled industries, tech companies, communication companies, et cetera. So these are workers that are absolutely directly competing with domestic workers in the United States. And there's a difference between those undocumented individuals that are here in a subservient but free labor contracting situation like any other domestic worker, notwithstanding a lot of the barriers to them. On the other hand, people that are brought in as contracted workers, in effect, is subjugated non-free labor. And what they really want to do is expand that element of controlled immigration into the United States. Subjugated non-free labor, non-free in the sense that the worker is not bound to the employer, not bound by a contract, not bound to the whims of an employer. Even an undocumented worker, for example, that is not satisfied with the conditions of employment can certainly voluntarily leave that employer and search employment elsewhere. But the design is to create additional programs to expand those that currently exist of contracted labor to work in essentially any industry in the United States, healthcare industry, retail, service industry, certainly agriculture, high-tech industry. That's why we see a lot of these high-tech companies that are pumping in literally millions of dollars advocating for supposed comprehensive immigration reform, because they want to bring in literally millions of high-skilled workers to work in their industries, but certainly under contracts and subpar wages versus investing in the native domestic workforce that is already here or up and coming in the schools, invest in them so they can be employed in those industries, but free labor.
Yes, I think you're referring to the H-1B and the L-1, L-2 visa programs where skilled workers are brought in, mostly from Asia, from India and other places in Asia, to do this tech work in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. I think since that program was developed in the late 90s under Clinton, we've had at least 1 to 2 million people who have come into the country that way. Many of them end up staying, and they are welcomed and allowed to stay. That, of course, means we're bringing in foreign nationals to take jobs that citizens should be trained for. It's a big excuse for the tech companies not to train people, and for the government not to pay for training in these new industries and just bring in foreign skilled labor. And no one's making a complaint about that, it doesn't sound like, but they are complaining about the
important point,
the unskilled.
Yeah, the important point to note in that, Jack, that a lot of people just kind of like gloss over. It costs money to form human labor. So even if it's low-paid agricultural labor coming from Mexico or from other countries or high-tech trained skilled workers, someone else invested to prepare and form that human capital that now is being brought into the United States under contract, literally with no investment. So it's a freebie for American capital to bring in workers that have already been formed by the country of origin, and yet in this country they would be exploited at subpar wages. So it's a freebie on both sides of the equation for American capital.
Yes, I recall years ago when I worked in the communications industry, those companies used to have big training, internal training programs. They used to train people, AT&T and others. They don't train anybody anymore because they just bring these already educated and trained people in to do the work. And, of course, it's at wages less than they used to pay in benefits and so forth. But let's talk about the immigration of the unskilled or semi-skilled, those who are on S-1 visas or not undocumented, because that seems to be the focus of the abuse right now, the severe abuse as far as immigrant deportations are concerned. And if either of you, we're going to take a very brief break here very shortly, but I want you to think about this thing of the Obama administration saying, I can't do anything, the Republicans are blocking me. Is that true? What could Obama do if he really wanted to do something by executive order? But let's take a very quick break, and we'll come back. And, David, maybe you pick that up. This is Alternative Visions. Host Jack Rasmus. We're talking about the immigrants' rights movement, and we'll be back very shortly.
Now sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming. I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades.
This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. My guests, Nativa Lopez and David Bacon, and we're talking about the immigrants' rights movement in the U.S. And before the break, I had thrown out a question about can't the Obama administration do something for immigrants based on executive order rather than legislation, which, of course, his whole term, not much has been passed because of Republican opposition and bad strategy on the part of the Democrats in Congress and legislatively. But that's another question. David, what do you think about that that question? And then let's talk about the movement itself today and what it's demanding and what's happening and what will be happening.
Okay. I want to start by going back to what Nativo said about the impact of this contract system on the countries that people are coming from, because, you know, what we have is really what's called the brain drain. In other words, you know, the Philippines, for instance, spends a lot of money, devotes a lot of resources in educating people and training them to be doctors. And then those people, those doctors, leave the Philippines and wind up working in U.S. and Canadian hospitals as nurses because we won't recognize their certification. It's kind of a form of racism, really. And the Philippines loses all of its money, basically, that it invested in the training of those people. You know, when I worked for National Semiconductor in a big electronics plant in Silicon Valley, I worked next to a woman who was washing glass plates for a living at close to minimum wage, who had gotten a doctorate in microbiology at the University of the Philippines in Manila. You know, she was here in the United States basically in order to send money back to support her family at home. But again, all the money that was invested in her doctorate was lost to the Philippines, and it was lost to us here, too, because she couldn't get recognition for that visa here or for that kind of education. And what it does is it produces an economy, a world economy, in which some countries are dependent on remittances, on the money that is being sent home. Mexico is. El Salvador, the money being sent home by Salvadoran workers here in the United States, is the number one source of national income in El Salvador. Mexico is number two or number three on the order of $25-30 billion a year. In the Philippines, you know, countries are planning their economic development strategy based on this money coming back. So what you get then are governments that lobby for these kinds of work programs in the United States because they see it as a way of basically propping up their economies, especially not restructuring their economies so that they can provide work and a decent future for people at home where they're living, which is another thing I think we need to talk about at some point, you know, which is the movements of people in countries like Mexico and the Philippines for what they're calling the right to stay home. In other words, for economic development that gives people a future where they are, rather than seeing that the only future that people have is one of migrating somewhere else and sending money back home. And here in the United States, then what we get are overwhelmingly immigrants that are being brought in. And you're talking about, Jack, especially the visas for agricultural workers like H-2A, or the visas for low-skilled workers in other jobs, which is called H-2B. In these programs, what's really happening is the immigrants are competing against immigrants. You know, the workers who were fired at Gibbers Farms were immigrants from Mexico. The workers who went on strike at Sukuma Brothers Farms in Washington State last year are immigrants from Oaxaca, and they're being replaced by other immigrants being brought from, in this case, Durango in Mexico. So you have immigrants being forced into competition with each other, basically, so that it provides a kind of a wage subsidy in keeping wages low. You know, so in terms of what the demands of a movement are, I think that we ought to take a look at the person who I know that both Nativo and I look at as being kind of the father of the immigrant rights movement, and what he, Bert Corona, stood for. The solution that was proposed by Bert Corona, by even Cesar Chavez, by other people during the 1960s, at the height of the civil rights movement, when they got rid of the Bracero program, what they advocated was an immigration system that, instead of tearing families apart and deporting U.S. citizen children because they have no alternative but to leave with their deported parents, what we need is an immigration system that supports families and supports communities, that allows people to reunify their families where they are. That was why we set up the family preference system, which was the basis of U.S. immigration law from 1965 until 1986, when we started moving backwards again towards, you know, an immigration system that was oriented towards supplying, you know, workers to employers. So,
well, is that one of the demands, David, if I may interrupt you, of the movement today, to substitute the current, let's just deport everybody and bring some people in at subpar programs? Is that part of the demands of the movement today?
We're trying to defend what little we have, because, you know, they have starved that system of visas. So we have waiting lines right now in Mexico City. If you're living in the United States and you apply for a visa for your married adult child living in Mexico City, the wait time right now is about 20 years. In Manila, it's about 22 years. So they have starved that system for visas to the point where people are dying in the line, just waiting to be able to join their families here. So one of the demands is clearly to do what's called clear the backlog. In other words, hand out visas to all the people who are waiting in line. That goes along with giving legal status to the people who are already here. You know, we need legal status for people who are here without papers, and we also need to make sure that people who have petitions for their relatives to be able to come and join them here can actually do this within a lifetime, really. And instead, what we're getting, those bills that were in Congress, you know, the one that passed the Senate last June, the one that the Democrats are supporting in the House of Representatives, you know, to say nothing of the Republicans, they chip away at that system. They are proposing, for instance, to eliminate the preference category for brothers and sisters, so you won't be able to petition for your brother or sister to come here, to eliminate the category for adult married children, as though once our children are grown up and they're adults, we don't need them any longer. They should just, you know, disappear off the face of the earth. You know, so we are fighting to defend what we have. We are fighting for visas that will make the system work. And also what they have in these bills is that they say it very, very openly, that they need what they are calling a merit-based system, meaning that if you want to come to the United States, that you have to accumulate points according to how employable you are, meaning that if there's some business that thinks that it wants to hire you because you're either going to be a cheap worker in a field or you're going to be a cheap worker in an electronics plant, then you get to come to the United States. But if the criteria is that you have your mother or father who are living here, forget it, you know? That's the choices that we are facing now, and these are some of the kinds of demands that people are fighting for.
Nativa, what are the demands as you see them, priority demands of the movement today, of the administration? In other words, what are you demanding of the administration do? One, to stop these deportations, I guess, and not just stop the deportations, but as David implies, to improve the situation for immigrant workers in general.
Well, first and foremost, the immediate demand is to stop the deportation machine and to accord administrative relief to all eligible undocumented currently in the United States in the face of stalled immigration reform. There will be no immigration legislation under this Congress, and obviously anticipating negative news in the midterm elections, the president is going to head into a lame duck 2 years finalizing his second term, probably with a Congress even more hostile than currently exists. So that's why the two demands that are of urgent immediacy being raised, stop the deportations and accord administrative relief, basically meaning extending a temporary legal status to all those that are eligible currently in the United States. But long term,
Administrative relief means temporary legal status until you could work something out better longer term. Is that correct?
That's correct. That allow okay. people to remain here to work, work legally, even travel to their country of origin, be paroled back into the United States, adjust the status that are those that are of all those individuals that are currently in the United States that have immigration petitions pending. They're already on the wait list. There's a lot of talk about, you know, people that are in the line. Let's take care of the people in the line first. The president can do that. That can be done easily through executive order. And that would create incredible relief for the 4.5 million people that are on the waiting list to get their visa to lawfully come to the United States or to adjust their status in that they are already here in the United States. But we would just juxtapose what has been proposed in Congress and by this administration they call comprehensive immigration reform with what we call fair and humane immigration reform. And first and foremost, as David mentioned, that means reunification of families. You know, these people talk so much about family values, but yet they propose legislation that actually separate and malign the family unit. And we stand for true family values, and that means families should be together, families should be able to work, families should be able to travel. And if you allow people to work lawfully, then it would be more difficult for employers to exploit undocumented, unprotected labor that is being used against American domestic labor. So it's extremely important that undocumented workers be legalized, and that's part of the Fair and Humane Immigration Reform, a legalization program that allows people to adjust their status to permanent resident status, receive work authorization, be allowed to travel, and then they would be more apt to join unions and work along with American workers, reestablishing American unions as a leverage of negotiation for improved wages, conditions of work, etc., as actually existed in the 1960s, where 35% of the American workforce actually was affiliated with the union. Today, the private workforce is hovering less than 6%. You know, that's an abomination in this day and age of the incredible wealth that exists in this country. And yet we find ourselves competing against ourselves and the president and the Democratic-controlled Congress on the Senate side proposing legislation, for example, that would actually undermine the status of American workers and undermine the status of American middle class by negotiating, continue to negotiate trade agreements that Ross Perot in 1992 said would create a huge sucking noise or sucking sound, eliminating manufacturing jobs from the American landscape, and that is exactly what occurred under the North America Free Trade Agreement, and what would be NAFTA on steroids if we allow this president to negotiate the Pacific Rim Trade Agreement that he's secretly negotiating behind the backs of the American people, behind the backs of members of Congress, and is going to be the subject of his current travels to Asia to see if he can move that forward on the American agenda.
Yes, we've had shows on this Trans-Pacific Partnership and the attempt to create a North Atlantic, Europe-U.S. Trans-Atlantic Partnership free trade agreements.
Jack,
so we'll probably have more on that, but go ahead.
Jack,
was that David? Go ahead.
I wanted to follow up on two very, very important things that people mentioned here. One of them is, you know, the ability of immigrant workers to join unions and to fight for their labor rights, especially undocumented people. And one change in immigration law that I know that Nathibo has fought for a long time and many other people as well is to decriminalize work. Right now we have a part of our immigration law that says that employers can't hire people without papers and that people without papers are cannot legally work. And what this leads to is pressure by the government on employers to fire workers. Employers never really get punished for this stuff. But what happens is that thousands of workers lose their jobs, and it makes it very, very difficult for undocumented people to exercise their labor rights by joining unions and complaining about illegal wages because their presence in the workforce itself is illegal. So we need to change that part of immigration law, which is called repealing employer sanctions, because employer sanctions is the section of the current law that basically makes it a crime for somebody who's undocumented to work. The other one is, you know, on the question of the trade agreements, in addition to fighting against the negotiation of the TPP and calling for the renegotiation of NAFTA, we need to kind of incorporate language about trade agreements into immigration law itself, so that as part of our immigration law, we have sections that say that the United States cannot negotiate a trade agreement if its effect is going to be to displace people in the countries that we're negotiating with because of the increase in poverty or the increase in unemployment or this kind of displacement. If we talk about putting that kind of language into our immigration law, what's also going to happen is that we are going to wind up with a lot of friends in Mexico, for instance, in Oaxaca, because there are people in Oaxaca, in Mexico, who are fighting for the same thing, basically, who are saying that people in Oaxaca should have some alternatives to forced migration. Not that there's something wrong or immoral or bad about migrating, but that people, it should be a voluntary process in which people can choose not to do it as well, meaning that there have to be the basic things that create a decent life, jobs and schools and health care and economic development, a future, in other words, for young people who are growing up. So if we talk about changing our trade policy so that it doesn't displace people, we are going to have something that we can advocate for on both sides of the border at the same time, I think.
Okay, it sounds to me like we have demands potentially in a whole number of areas. Maybe if I can just summarize, we've talked about demands on the administration regarding revising this bad piece of legislation that exists. We've got demands that have to do with the free trade agreements, past and future, coming. And then the most important sounds to be these demands to immediately stop the worst of these deportations. and give workers, immigrant workers, the right to work, temporary legal status here, administrative relief, until we can get something better. Now, you know, I agree with you. I don't think Obama is going to get a damn thing in terms of legislation, and maybe he knows that, and that's why he's not doing relief by executive order here, but just sort of pointing the finger and blaming the Republicans. It's probably the subject of another show, but I think the Democrats and Obama are in deep trouble with the midterm elections coming, and as Nativo suggested, they may end up with even less support in Congress, and Obama may have even less ability to do anything by executive order. If he doesn't have both houses of Congress and he tries an executive order approach after November, well, Congress, in the hands of the Republicans, will just negate all that. So he really, in my view, only has a short window here between now and November to do something positive by executive order. It seems to me that's the only direction that something could happen positively between now and November. Well, that's just my view. I may be absolutely wrong on that, but that's how I see it, that the solutions, even if they are minor, can only come by executive order. Tell us what's happening, Nativo, with the movement itself. How is there a kind of a resurgence, a regeneration of activity going on among the immigrant rights groups? And if so, what's its character?
Well, before I mention that, I want to also include something that's on the agenda of the immigrant rights movement, and that is to slow down the insidious expansion of the enforcement apparatus of the state, incredibly expanded under the Obama administration. Not anticipated that he would do that, but he has done even much more than what the Bush administration did in terms of expanding the enforcement apparatus of the state, and that is by expanding the number of border enforcement officials on the border, now exceeding 22,000. Expansion of workforce enforcement through the E-Verify program, expedited court hearings along the border to remove individuals without real representation in hearings in the court, the meshing of police databases with federal databases, which is a very insidious intelligence gathering operation, combining local and federal police enforcement capability, and all designed to gain greater control of the workforce. And some would say, well, that's okay if it's, you know, designed to use that on immigrants, against immigrants, etc. But we should not be so naive to think that anything that's experimented on immigrants would not be used on the Native American-born workforce in favor of American capital. And that's the other expansion area is the detention centers that have been privatized under the previous administration and this administration that now obligates a budget allocation for permanent 35,000 beds in these detention facilities that must be filled on a daily basis by detaining immigrants. And so that's what we're observing by this administration, expansion of the state into the private lives of American workers, immigrant workers, and used in a very punitive manner. The immigrant rights movement has seriously been fragmented by another very insidious infusion of ostensibly to support immigrants by what I would call a professional, well-funded, multi-million-dollar funded immigrant rights agencies based in Washington, D.C. that are working in tandem with the Democratic Party to essentially co-op local good leadership of immigrant rights movements throughout the country, frighten that movement, and impose a comprehensive immigration reform model that has been designed in Washington by the politicians and by these professional advocates, and really not listening to what immigrant families and immigrant workers are saying in the field.
I think you say two very important things here that listeners ought to make note of, and that is there are attempts by politicians and business interests to create competing organizations that allege to represent themselves as groups representing the movement that are really, you might say, domestic NGOs, non-government organizations, that are really there as vehicles of the politicians and their business interests to confuse everybody who's really leading the movement. And I think the other thing that you said that listeners should make note, and I don't want to sound like a conspiratorialist, but when you say there's 22,000 agents on the southern border and they're experimenting with all these new technologies and ways of rounding up people and detention of people. This sounds to me like a dress rehearsal of working out the kinks of how to round up large numbers of protesters and put them in a place where they no longer can be a problem politically if conditions should deteriorate significantly further in the U.S. Okay, maybe I sound like a conspiratorialist, but I just don't trust this government and these people and their motives, and I'm sure they see what they're doing on the border as a way of pioneering some new ways of mass control that they may find useful on other occasions.
It's not conspiratorial. It's happening today, and we absolutely know that that'll be applied to the domestic workforce and the American people. Use of drones, surveillance, intelligence gathering, you know, all of that, we absolutely know that it will be or it's already being used on the American people. So I know David could speak much more to that point as well, because he's traveled back and forth.
Well, maybe we need to get both of you fellas. Last comment. Go ahead, David.
There's a hunger strike that's been going on for a month in the detention center in Tacoma by the people who are being detained there, who are also the workforce that does all the work in that detention center. So those detention centers are also the location of some of the most important resistance and the grassroots part of our movement, not the Washington lobbyists, but, you know, those grassroots organizations that are fighting for immigrant rights on the ground that include, in this case, the people inside the center, the deportees themselves.
Right. Okay, I'm going to thank both of you, you fellows, for coming on. Thank you for giving us this updated view, and not only the importance of this issue today for the millions of people who are being abused by it, but for maybe the rest of us down the road as well, in terms of wages and jobs and our unions and surveillance and so on and so forth. This affects everybody. It's not just immigrants. Okay, we'll be back again next week. And we're going to have a follow-up with Staunton Lynn on this question, are American unions at a strategic impasse? What needs to be done? And I will have some of my own views on that. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, next week.